Okay, Rabbi, should we begin? Okay, I'm going to.
You're still muted.
Okay, Rabbi Kelman's muted. Yes.
Yes.
Okay, Rabbi Kelman, do you want? He can hear me. You want me to say anything, or I'm going to start? Okay, I don't think he's.
I can't read his lips.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, there you are. Okay, Rabbi.
Okay, hold on. Okay, fine. I figured it out. I'm
Yes.
sorry about that. Okay. Welcome, everybody. Okay, thank you. You can start. I'm sorry. I don't want to keep
Okay.
you waiting. Welcome,
Okay,
everybody, to
everyone.
a new
Thank you,
series.
and welcome again. Thank you for the Kelmans, for all they do to make this possible. When I finish the classes on the Mir Yeshiva, which really I could go on. In fact, the last all my classes on the Gedolim, we were continuous, so I could always comment on things. But I'm going to push that aside. The only thing I would want to say is I think I was a little in describing the Chabad reaction to Rav Aharon. I think I didn't characterize it properly. You have Meshugaim who think crazy stuff like he was evil and everything, but that's not the main view. The main view is they're very critical of his response. But they certainly don't regard him as an evil person, except for the Meshugaim. But even that, we said, was a mistake that they don't really know that Rav Aharon had a very good relationship with Chabad, relatively speaking, etc. But so leaving that aside, people asked me to do more classes. And they gave me all these ideas of people to do. And I'd like to do them. And in fact, I have my own ideas. I want to do one Rav Shimon Shkup. I want to do one Rav Mordechai Elyahu. There's a number. The problem is Rabbi Weissmandel, who we spoke about in the last class. He's not really one of the Gedolim, but a very important figure in Holocaust history. And the problem is I don't have the books I need. I won't do a class unless I have all the material, the academic writings, much as online, but I actually need the books. And until we can get back to where we need to be, I can't order interlibrary loans. So I was thinking about what to do. And then I thought, well, just like the Mir talk on the Mir Yeshiva grew out of the talk I was supposed to give on Pesach and also the talk on Kitnios. So I figured I was supposed to speak on the theme of my latest book, A 30-Year Story. So why not do that? Now, it's not really about me. I'm not telling you about me, but I'm telling you about the many great figures in my relationship. And I'm sure you'll find this all of interest. So let me explain what I want to do. We have it scheduled for two sessions, but I'm going to start through after the introduction explaining. I'm just going to start going through the various questions. And if you find it interesting, we can continue going on in subsequent weeks. What is this book that I'm referring to? And incidentally, I left a link in the chat if anyone wants to buy it. Someone sells it. Let me show you a picture first of what we're talking about and what I did here. Here it's called the title of the book is Igros Malchei Rabbanan, which the phrase Malchei Rabbanan is used in the Talmud to refer to to great rabbis. They have a play on words, and they use that. And my name, my Hebrew name, is Melech. So there's a like a double play here. It's traditional to associate books with names. So what is this book? I decided after I have ever since I was a youth, I've been interested in the rabbis. And when I was about 19, I began to correspond with some of the great rabbis. Every one of the rabbis, by the way, this is going to be about the Gedolim, because every figure we deal with, I'm going to tell you about them and who they are, and we're going to go through page after page. And last year, I decided, actually a year and a half ago, that after all this time, I have all these letters, I have enough for a, here it is, a sefer, an actual sefer of about 375 pages to put it together. It's actually, in a sense, people have said it's unique. In that I don't, and I agree, I don't know of any other sefer in which you have letters from everyone from the most right-wing Zionists to Satmar, all in one. And the issues we're going to talk about, the issues that are of interest to me, and if you read my writings, you know that my the things that interest me are not what interests many others, more off the beaten track. And yet, as someone said to me, I was able to get these great rabbis, many of them, to comment on things that no one else is asking them. And maybe that's why they decided to comment on it, because no one asked these questions. And if you're going to ask me, how do I have a relationship with this one and that one? You know, I don't come from that world. I don't come from the yeshiva world. One of the upshots is that a lot of these great rabbis actually are interested in off the beaten track. They spend their lives in one way, but they have these other broad interests, and they seem to enjoy at least exploring these other things when it's not day or night, to use the Talmudic expression. Now, before we get into the heart of it, the bibliographical point, incidentally, so I say it's just 30 years, more than 30 years of correspondence. If you count the fact, the letter we'll see from the Lubavitch Rebbe when I was 13 years old, you're talking over 40 years, or just about 40 years. But a bibliographical point to start with. This book is significant. Someone asked me if I'm going to discuss letters from Rabbi Greenblatt, including a particular one. Yes, I will discuss that. You're not the only one who just texted me who called attention to that. A bibliographical point. This volume, Iros Malchei Rabbanan, is, to my knowledge, the third book in history ever published with Catholic money, that is, the assistance of Catholic money. The Catholics throughout history have been involved, of course, in the past at least, of destroying Jewish books and creating problems for us. This book was published, as it says, with assistance from my university. I have a chair, so the Judaic Studies Institute. And I'm going to show you. So then what are the first two? Well, the first two volumes were actually books I published. So let me show you now. This is a bibliographical point here. I published two volumes of the collected writings of Rabbi Achiyak of Weinberg. So here you have Volume 1 of the writings of Rabbi Achiel Yaakov Weinberg. And if you look on the English title page, it says, published with the generous assistance of the University of Scranton and its Judaic Studies Institute. I don't know if people listening now are aware of this. The University of Scranton is a Jesuit university. So I don't know, do we have 26, 25, I think, in America? Here in New York, you know, Fordham is Jesuit, Boston College, Georgetown, Marquette, Creighton, a number of them. So this, as far as I know, the first volume I published was the very first volume ever published with Catholic money, which I think is of interest. So this will be the third volume. I like to joke that if I taught at a place like Holy Cross or something like that, I couldn't put that there, published with the assistance of Holy Cross. But it's interesting. So I want to get right to it. What I have in the volume, it's divided into various sections, Jewish law, philosophical question. There's a whole, it starts with Orach Chaim, you know, the four sections of Shulchan Aruch, ways of deciding halacha, things dealing with the state of Israel, you know, about books, etc. So I just want to go through, in the time I have this week and next week, go through the various questions that I came across. You're going to learn about me and my life a bit, and you're going to learn about some of these great rabbis. So I just am going to start volume, and if you want to buy it on your own, I said I gave the link. And as we go along, I'll talk about how the connections, etc. So if you open up the book to Chelek Aleph, you have an interesting question that it's addressed. The person I addressed it to, let me show you now, his picture. Let's go back to here. And here he is. His name was Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt. I don't know if anyone, if you know him, he died in 2014. He has I believe it's his nephew, although they're almost about the same age, who's in Memphis now. His name is Rav Nota Greenblatt. Rav Ephraim Greenblatt, he authored a number of volumes of Respons. I think it's 8 volumes, called Rivvos Ephraim. He was, I think you can say, the Talmud Muvak of Rav Moshe Feinstein. There are more letters in the egress Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein, to Rav Ephraim Greenblatt than anyone else. Who was Rav Ephraim Greenblatt? Now, I don't think Rav Natan's the uncle. Okay, correct. And thank you for telling me that. Yeah. Just a little bit. Yeah. So let me tell you about who Rav Ephraim Greenblatt was and how I made the connection, because there's many, many letters to me from Ephraim Greenblatt. I didn't include all the letters. I still have a number of letters if I ever wanted to do another volume, although the letters I mean, most I have are not that significant. But who was Rav Ephraim Greenblatt? He comes from Jerusalem. Big Talmud Chacham, studied in the yeshivas there, comes to America. When he was about 19 or so, and he was supposed to be a rabbi. His grandfather was there, and then he told me he didn't speak a word of English when I came here. And then he enrolls in MTJ, and he's there for many years until Rav Moshe Feinstein sends him to Memphis. There was an opportunity, and he spent his entire life in Memphis until at the end of his years he went to Israel. The last years were not so pleasant for him because he had invested money with Madoff. He wasn't a very wealthy man, but he had people, and you know, he had a whole connection. He had connections, and they got him in. That he it was a big zechus. He thought that he could invest with Madoff, even though he's not investing millions, but he must have had a couple hundred thousand. And he said that there was a whole story. You can Google this and see it. That he gave he wanted to give each one of his grandchildren $50,000 when they got married, and he made a lot of money. It turns out, though, it was not real money. So he lost everything. And then his wife, unfortunately, was killed in hit by a car. And at the last few years he was living in Israel, his sfarim were still in Memphis. He probably had the biggest library of Torah works outside of the New York area and the big city, Chicago, on this part of the country. And as far as I know, they're still there. And but he was... He became an important posek in Memphis, as well as rabbis asking him all sorts of questions. What they don't tell you is, and I don't know if this is written anywhere, he was a member of the Irgun. I can't imagine that they would tell us this today because they wouldn't want you to know about this. He's born in 1932, as I recall. He told me, and he wasn't embarrassed by it at all, that when he was a young teenager, he was working for the Irgun. He would pass messages. You know, he would bring messages from one place to another. And then in 1948, when he was 16 years old, he actually was involved. I don't know how much in terms of fighting or just carrying a gun. I don't know. But he was in Deir Yassin. And, Rashida Tlaib, you know, she sent the thing out the other day about the Nakba. Commemorate the Nakba, you know, we commemorate it also, the fact that they didn't kill all the Jews in Israel. She's commemorating that, you know, they didn't succeed either. So you can ask her what she means by that. But Deir Yassin stands out in the popular mind as, you know, the massacre, the great massacre that Israel committed against the Arabs. Of course, if there was a massacre there, that's one versus all the massacres, and that was their intent. But even that, I can't say if it's really happened. You know, Begin in the revolt denies it. And Rabbi Greenblatt, who was in Deir Yassin, said to me, he says, I can't tell you that there were no innocents killed. What I can tell you from being there, he said, is that I did not see any of that. So I don't know, you know, if you can take that to the bank as meaning anything. But, you know, so this very interesting rabbinic figure of Ephraim Greenblatt, like I said, you can look online, let me know. I couldn't find any references that he was a member of the Irgun. I mean, he came from an interesting family also. I mean, he told me his family was very close to Rav Herzog and the Brisker Rav. He said they would go every week to a different place, you know, Shalashuddas. First they go one week to Rav Herzog and then next week to the Brisker Rav. And he said, and the extremists never had a problem with Rav Herzog until he told me the Shabbos after the state was declared. So it's right around this time, maybe exactly around this time. He said that Shabbos they were in the shul with Rav Herzog and some kanai comes in and starts screaming and picks up a chair and throws it in the direction of Rav Herzog, calling him, you know, allied with the heretics and everything. And he said that the yeshiva students made a circle around Rav Herzog after davening and they walked him home to protect him. So that was Rabbi Greenblatt. I eventually had a nice relationship, and I'm a musmach of his, actually. So let me tell you about the question I asked him. Question is, it's stated Sivan, so let's say June 1987. I was going to go that summer to Ethiopia. I was a junior, and my junior year, myself and my brother, who was a high school student at the time, we were going to Ethiopia. And I'll get to the questions at the end. By the way, Shiner, it's meant, he discusses it in his Motzei Shabbos talk. I can show you. So I was going to Ethiopia. I was involved at that time with something called NACOJ, North American Conference on Ethiopian Jewry. We did a whole event in my house. I got into that, and they were having a mission there. And my parents, they actually gave me permission to go, and they gave my brother permission to go. And the principal of his high school wasn't too happy, missing school. But in any event, so we went. And it was an amazing experience. I was with Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky. Some of you probably know the great Dr. Ari Zivotofsky, who's also involved in Torah Moshe. That's where I first met him, and we spent a week and a half or so together in Egypt and in Ethiopia. My question was as follows. At the time, they were becoming more interested in Judaism, and Chacham Avad Yosef had already ruled they're absolutely Jews. The question is, my tefillin. It was a communist country, and we had to be very careful what we could bring in. And this is a question that came up during the Soviet era as well. Could I leave my tefillin with and my brother in Ethiopia with the people there? It could be that it might be a day or so I might not be able to put on tefillin because, Ari was going one way. The rest of the people there were not really religious. And in other words, I'm giving up putting in my tefillin on so that they could have it. That's a temporary thing. And for them, it's, could be permanent, or for who knows when they're going to get out. It's not like we could send them tefillin. So that was the question. After all, the issue of tefillin is of interest because what is a tefillin? Like, we were careful to put it on every day, but really you're supposed to wear it all day. Yeah, they used to in the olden days. There are some people, if you go to the old city today in Jerusalem, they call them the Zilberman people. If you see people walking around the Jewish quarter of the old city with these tefillin, they're in the group, the Zilbermans. They have a whole derech of learning, of chinuch, and they look like Haredim, but they're really not really entirely Haredi. They wear tcheles, and they wear the tefillin all day. So very unusual. And of course, they wear the small tefillin. You can't wear the big ones. But we assume, so you're supposed to have the mitzvah every day. But So what does that mean, though? If you miss a day, is it a problem? So I asked Rabbi Greenblatt, and his answer was, and by the way, the same answer I saw in the book of Rabbi Goldschmidt, Rabbi Pinchas Goldschmidt, who's the Rav of Moscow, the non-Hasidic Rav of Moscow. The Soviet Union is basically dominated by Chabad, but there's Rabbi Goldschmidt, who's very involved in the Council of European Rabbis. His son is Rabbi Benji Goldschmidt, who's the assistant rabbi at Rabbi Schneierschule, is at Park East, I think it's called. So Rabbi Goldschmidt published a sefer about 20 years ago with the same question regarding Russia, and he came up with the same answer. Rabbi Greenblatt says, Tov shetashir. It's good that you leave your tefillin there. Af im yomo yomayim. Even if one or 2 days, you won't be able to put on tefillin. Ki zeh hatzalas rabim. Bezeh chashuva od. And then he says, I will give you proofs for that later. But in the meantime, he never sent me the letter with that. But he says to leave the tefillin, which I think makes sense. I can't imagine anyone disagreeing with that when you deal with... because it's not like it's a positive commandment it's not like you're violating something, I don't think, per se. And even if you are, you have a chance of giving someone the opportunity to wear it for many, many more days, and you'll just miss one or 2 days. So that was the psak of Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt. In general, when you hear the psak of Rabbi Ephraim, and I often thought of this, in a sense, he was in Memphis all this time. He went there, he was the shochet, he was involved in the school. He was not the Rav of Memphis, or the Rav of Memphis was Rabbi Grossman. And there's always more than one shul in Memphis, but you read about Memphis in that novel, I forget what it's called. What's the novel? The woman writer, she wrote the novel about Memphis. And I forget who it is. I'm sure some of you know that. And everyone I know, they try to identify who that is. But he was, because he was in Memphis, he was...
Tova Mervis.
There you go. Thank you.
Ladies
Auxiliary. Thank you, Mel. In Memphis, of course, you're not dealing with the same sort of community like a yeshiva community. And you see this among the letters. I mean, I get the sense that some people would write to him, they'd write to him from B'nai Brak and others, they think he's in Borough Park or something. They don't realize what type of community this is. In fact, in one of his svarim, it was dedicated to a young man who died young, I think before he even went to college or when he was in college. And he talks about how, you know, they have a whole thing in English in this fraternity and all that. I also got the sense that because Rabbi Greenblatt was not living in Brooklyn or Muncie or something, he sort of was like behind the times. He didn't realize maybe the world changed, because he could still say things that were sort of that, you know, in the major centers of Jewish life, it's not necessarily acceptable anymore, like Glatt Kosher, things like that. Everyone knows that if you're in the major centers, already by the 80s, you know, everything had to be Glatt Kosher. And so I got a sense sometimes that he was, because he was living in Memphis, and I'll give you some examples of that perhaps, of that when we get to other of his letters, where it's sort of, well, I can just tell you right now, you know, he is the Talmud Mufak of Ramosha Feinstein, but Ramosha Feinstein is known to have no fear. It's unbelievable with Ramosha. I mean, you can't say this about Rav Soloveitchik, for instance. He wouldn't, often he wouldn't say things publicly. He didn't want to get involved in disputes. Rabbi Chirak of Weinberg certainly wouldn't say certain things publicly. Ramosha did not, apparently had no fear. And when rabbis are not supposed to. It says Lo Saguru. They're supposed to give psak without having fear, but that's easier said than done. And we all know that there's crazies and extremists will destroy you if you say things they don't like. But Ramosha apparently didn't have this issue. If you know about his history, he gave all sorts of psakim. The most famous one was artificial insemination with a non-Jewish man for a Jewish woman, where the Hasidim and others went crazy. And he didn't seem to bother him. I can't say that about Rabbi Greenblatt. I can give an example. I'm not going to say exactly what the details were, but I once asked him a question at Brandeis because I was what they call the Orthodox advisor there. Later, there's like five questions dealing with the history of Brandeis University in this book, which I think you'll find of interest. I once asked him a question. What happened was that there's a kollel in Boston, and they moved in like 1990. And I actually became involved with them. I would learn there a few days a week. And one of the guys, and I was very helpful to them. One of the guys started coming to Brandeis. He's been doing it now for since like 1990. And but it created some tension because I don't think it would today, but this was the first time that some of these Kowal guys who had ever had any contact with, I guess, people in more modern. And it created a little tension. One thing I can give an example of is this, where we set up a base medrash there. And it's there to this day in Brandeis. When I was there, they set up a base medrash. I remember Marvin Fox spoke at the dedication, which, if you know who Marvin Fox was, it's very unusual because the students never had any real relationship with him ever, even though he was an unbelievable chacham, and he's a musmach also. So we had this base medrash. And so people would come and learn. And the Lakewood guy, he was giving Gemara shiur there, and he didn't want any women in it, which I guess is fine. It's his shiur, but he didn't want any women in the base medrash when he was giving the Gemara shiur. And he actually made it clear that he didn't want any, and that no women should be in there. And they came to me and they complained, and I had to actually tell them that the students, that it's fine if they want to have a boys only Gemara shiur, but it can't be in the base medrash, because we can't say that from like 8 to 9 on Tuesday night no women are allowed in the base medrash. It's a community thing. So they moved to a different place. So an issue came up, which again I don't need to go into the details, but I called Rabbi Greenblatt, and he gave psak I was looking for, the psak that really was needed to keep the Orthodox community the way it was. But he said to me, don't tell them that I gave you the psak. Because and he explained, because he didn't want to be, you know, on the out there were then subject to attacks, which of course is putting me in a difficult situation because I'm telling them I asked the post-sake and they're going to say, well, which post-sake? You know, for all they know, this is before Open Orthodoxy, but it could have been, you know, some left wing. But in any event, they had to trust me that I asked the post-sake. But I mean, so even Rabbi Greenblatt was afraid that it would, maybe he was afraid of going up against the Lakewood types because, I mean, they were the ones who created the issue. And I had to then go to Rabbi Greenblatt and explain to him that we have the Lakewood Kollel, which is telling us that you can't do this. But if we listen to them, it'll create big problems. So he told me, no, you can do it. Don't tell them that you got a psak, but don't tell them who gave you the psak. So that was Rabbi Greenblatt. Okay. The next question, I'll get to all the things as we, at the end. I always wait at the end and 10 minutes to the end, I get to the comments. And I see we're already half hour, we're only on to Siman Aleph. So maybe we'll be here a while. I'm willing to do it if you guys are willing to do it. The next question also relates to my time at Brandeis as a student. And it's addressed, it comes from this person who many of you recognize. You all recognize who this is? Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, someone who will do classes on, he was the Rishon LeZion, the Sephardic chief rabbi, after Chacham Avad Yosef, a very important figure, more on the religious Zionist wing than Chacham Avadia, but he was chief rabbi. And here's the question. This question takes us back to 1985. Actually, no, I'm sorry. This is not when I was in Brandeis. The next question from him is when I was in Brandeis. This is when I was in Israel. So we deal with more than 30 years ago. I was learning in Israel and I saw something interesting. I went to BMT. Maybe some of you listening went to BMT. I think Torah Shraga today is the continuation of BMT. But BMT, as Rabbi Rakefet likes to put it, was the, I forget his exact lashon, the first yeshiva to bring Torah to the Anglo-Saxon world, something like that. It was the first yeshiva for American, like modern Orthodox, to go learn. And that began the revolution. When it began, BMT, in the early 70s, it wasn't for after high school. It wasn't gap year. It was like people took a year off of college or even after college. And BMT was a great place, and a lot of greatness came out of BMT. Unfortunately, they never planned ahead. They received all their money. They were funded by the Israeli government through the Sochnut, the Torah Education Department. And BMT has more alumni than any other yeshiva in the modern Orthodox world, and they could have tapped into this, but they didn't. And then they really it couldn't survive once the money was taken away. But when I was in Israel, that was the first time I really had any contact with Sephardim. We had Syrians at BMT. There weren't that many schools. Today they could go to their own schools, but a whole contingent from Flatbush and other places. And the question I had, which of course is an old question, although it really only becomes practical with the return to Eretz Yisrael, you have it rarely in other places, but generally Ashkenazim and Sephardim didn't live together. When they lived together, they didn't daven together. I mean, if you came on my trip to Budapest, you remember, you have one of the, because they had Sephardim. Budapest is one of the only places, Buda, where the Sephardim and Ashkenazim lived together. But of course, they had separate synagogues, just like in Amsterdam, they had separate synagogues. But in Israel, all of a sudden, you have people in yeshivas where Sephardim and Ashkenazim are davening together. I asked the question a certain way because the Sephardim were the minority, but it could be done in reverse. How is a Sephardi supposed to daven with Ashkenazim? What are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to do the Nusach that Ashkenazim are davening? Are they supposed to have their own Siddur? Do we distinguish between Shema Esrei, which is a private prayer, so they should do their own thing, versus Kedusha, which is said out loud? What are you supposed to do? Now, among of the letters I got from Chacham Mordechai Eliyahu, the others were sent by him and signed by him, which makes them valuable today. These days, everything's valuable. If you read my Sfarim blog post that came out today, you see how much they're selling letters, any letter signed from a gadol. If you have a letter signed by the Satmar Rebbe or the Chavetz Chaim, you're talking $10,000. The problem is, as I spoke about in my post today, that encourages people to steal. And I wrote today about manuscripts that are, have been stolen, letters that have been stolen. So, but I have the letters, but this one is actually sent by his secretary. His secretary, who subsequently also became an important figure, Eliyahu Ben Dahan, who was a member of Knesset. He was in the cabinet. He's the guy, you know, from the Religious Zionists, the big long white beard, you know, the Santa Claus type big white beard and the big yarmulke. He was a Talmud Mufhak of Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, and he's a big Talmud Chacham. I don't think he's in the Knesset anymore. I mean, he was a huge figure in the National Religious Party. So my question was, how should a Sephardi, because I'm looking at all these Syrians in BMT, and I'm wondering, how are they supposed to daven? What are they supposed to do? So I wrote to, when I was in Israel already, I wrote to Mordechai Eliyahu. I don't know how I got his address. I probably just sent it to Hechel Shlomo. Rabbi Greenblatt, I got it because when I was in Brandeis, I discovered an unbelievable library. People don't realize this. Brandeis University Library. Then I went to Harvard, which is really unbelievable. Brandeis has so many Sfarim. It has a bigger collection of Sfarim than probably almost every yeshiva. It's definitely bigger than Lakewood. I was in the Lakewood Library, and I don't think there's any question that Brandeis is bigger. I mean, the Otsa Sfarim of Lakewood. And I found Robert Greenblatt's Sfarim, and it had his address on the inside. So I started sending him letters. But Rav Mordechai Eliyahu said that if a Sfardi, and it would be the reverse, an Ashkenazi, the Sfardi, quietly, you should say everything extra that the Sfardim say. I don't know if Sfardim generally do, but that's what he says. But if you're a, and the question is, what about the Chazan? He says, then it depends what the situation is. Today in many religious Zionist communities where Ashkenazi and Sfardim daven together, the minhag is whoever davens for the Yomud, that's what you do. So if a Sfardi gets up and he's the Chazan, you daven his nusach. And that's what he says. If the minhag is that every shlach tzibur does his minhag, it's not regarded as tirchut tzibura. It's not a burden to the community. But if the minhag is that the chazan has to go like the nusach, and BMT, I guess the nusach was, I don't know if it was official, but it was Ashkenazi, which means that a Sfardi would have to do Ashkenazic, couldn't do liatzmach perkane. You know, sometimes people get up and they all of a sudden assume that they're the chazan. So if they're nusach Sfardi, say liatzmach perkane. Well, why should they assume that? It's not the nusach of the community. If people don't care, I guess we all want Mashiach, so it's not such a big deal. But some people take this very seriously, and they think it's. And if you're in Budapest, in the Kaczynski Shul, since all the people basically who daven here are these Hasidim who go on the Kvarim tours, but it's a Nusach Ashkenaz Shul. It's an Nusach Ashkenaz Shul, and Mel can remember that. It's a Nusach Ashkenaz Shul to the extent that the Shochet, who's a Satmar Chassid, and the Rav, they don't wear strimals, because the tradition is that it has to be Nusach Ashkenaz everything. And right in the little minion you daven during the week, right on top it says, only Nusach Ashkenaz. So if you tread the Viasmach Barkane stuff there, they'll throw you out. And the Hasidim will throw you out because they know this is Nusach Chasam Sofer and everything. None of this Nusach Sfard. So he says that the Chazan has to do like the community. Not a difficult question, but I remember I was excited when I got it. The next question is also from Mordechai Eliyahu, and this is a very interesting question. It's a very interesting question because the question is so simple, and yet as far as I know, I looked, I couldn't find it, and none of the respondents, three of them, cite the Mishnah Berurah, so I assume it's not there. The Mishnah Berurah doesn't answer the question, as far as I can see. If I missed it, let me know, and then the others missed it also. The Aruch HaShulchan, as far as I know, doesn't miss it. And here's the question. It's from so 1986. I was a student at Brandeis University. As I said, there's five tshuvot dealing with Brandeis. I wrote a memoir, it's online, of my time in Brandeis. I discussed some of these. The question was as follows. Sunday, we would have minyan every day in Brandeis. Brandeis University is the only, as far as I know, it still is, it was then, it's the only university other than YU and Stern where there are three kosher meals a day. Many of them have lunch and dinner. Maybe today you have others at breakfast, but also it has an Erev. It was the only university that I was there when Rav Shimon Eider of Blessed Memory came up. He set up the Erev, and so there was, and we had a minyan every day. And this was when I was a student there. This is before there's a Beis Medrash. Sunday, we daven late. So let's say daven 9 o'clock. It's Sunday. You have to make it late. The problem was, in the winter, you could be coming up on Zman Tefillah. Now, the Minhag, what we used to do is there were a number of people. You'd still have this in small communities. We have it sometimes for Mincha Ma'ariv in communities. But they said that, you know, we're not, during the week, they have no problem going to Minyan. But on Sunday, that's the day they like to sleep in. But if you're at eight or nine people and it's questionable, they say you can call them. So you call them and then you wait 10, 15 minutes and they get there. Easy enough. And it worked. The problem was, and I raised the problem, no one else had raised this issue, they didn't even think about it, was we're calling them, and by the time they get to shul, it's after Zman Tefillah. So what do you do? You're missing one person. Zman Tefillah is, let's say, in 5 minutes or so, 10 minutes. You have the choice. You can call, and you'll get the minyan, but it'll be after the time of davening, the proper time. Or you ignore that and you daven by yourself, and then there's no minyan. What's more important, davening the proper time by yourself or davening with a minyan but after the proper time? I would think that this would come up lots of times, but as I said, I looked, I tried to find the answer myself. I couldn't find it. So I sent the questions to three Gedolei Yisrael. And I mean, you can ask your local rabbis. You'll see that it's 2 verses 1. I gave a talk on this a little while ago in my town about the book. And one of the students there asked Rabbi Willig. And Rabbi Willig came down with the 2 verses 1. But you'll see the 1 is Hasidic a bit. So you'll see the answer. So the first one is Mordechai Eliyahu. And he goes through the sources and he concludes that, because you know, there's also Chatzot. The thing is, the Shulchan Aruch says that you can actually daven to Chatzot, but you don't get to, it's not davening in the proper time. But it's davening, but it's not davening in the time. So it's like a lesser sort of davening. But after Chatzot, midday, you can't daven at all. So you might think that you can go at least to Chatzot, so you don't. It's not Tefillah Bizmana, but it's Tefillah. But Mordechai Yahu says no. He says that this is, you know, l'chachila here. This isn't the evidence. If you oversleep, then you have till chatzot. But no, you're making a choice. And he says that you need to daven by yourself before the zman, even if you don't have a minion. And listen to the reason he gives. In addition to explaining halachic reasons, he then says as follows, because we're going to see the exact opposite reasoning in the other tshuva that we're going to look at. He says, another reason why you can't wait, because you could make the argument, I guess, the halachic sources, I maybe could go both ways. He says is that if you wait, if you don't wait, then the people will see, because what happened was, you know, we call them. That was the issue. We call them, and I didn't explain it properly. We call them. And they'd say they'd be right there in 5 minutes, and it's already 10 minutes, and they're not here. Now what to do? If we start davening, we're in the proper time. Then they come in, and then they're all upset that they came for nothing, as it were. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu says no. He says, if you you shouldn't wait for them, because then this will encourage them, that they don't need to come early, and you're not going to have the demand. You daven, they'll come, they'll see they missed it. This will encourage them to come earlier. The question is that true? We're going to see the other posek says just the opposite. They'll be discouraged and they won't want to come at all. So you see how much of halacha sometimes is based on how you evaluate the situation. So the first one to decide this. Now, why did I write the 3? Because I didn't know if they're going to answer me. I figured I'd write the 3 people. I write to the 2 chief rabbis of Israel and then one other figure. So the first one, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu says, you have the choice between davening in the Zman or with a minyan. You daven with this Zman. The other day, well, it's not the other day anymore. It's because it's, you know, the last time we were out, we have a minion by my house sometimes. And there's one person in particular that we have to, he's not listening now, but if he is, it's okay. He knows we have to wait for him. He's often late. So it was after Shkia, or right about Shkia. And someone said to me, no, we have to start. We have to start Yechidus. And it's different though. Mincha is different. I said, no, you can go over Shkia. That already you have sources. It's all, you can go into Ben HaShmoshel. So if you're waiting, if no one's coming, then you daven before the Zman. But even a Litvak or a German Jew, a Yeki, if you're waiting for someone and the person has come, you can go already into Bein HaShmoshel. So that's okay. It's not the same thing as with Shachris. I'll get to the good comments there. Okay, so the next question, who'd I send it to next? As I said, here we go. Let me share the screen again. Here, Rav Avram Shapiro, the great Rav Avram Shapiro, who in addition to Chief Rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, was Rosh Yeshiva Merkaz HaRav. I have classes on Rav Avram Shapiro, if anyone online, if anyone wants to listen to some of them. And the answer from him came back as well. Also, this one is not through his secretary. Only, I think, two of the letters came from secretaries. And his answer is without question. According to the halakha, he says, it's better to daven tefillah bezmana, tefillah on the time, is better than davening tefillah with the tzibur, even if it's before chatzot. So now we have two people saying that we have to daven now instead of waiting for the third person to come. And then the next tshuva comes in from a very, very unusual posek who, let me show you his picture here. People can't believe that all the tshuvot to me from him. And here he is. This is none other than Rav Menashe Klein. His Hebrew writing is Menashe HaKatan. That's because in Yiddish and German, Klein is Katan. Klein means small. Who was Rav Menashe HaKatan? What does Mark Shapiro have to do with Menashe HaKatan? And me and Elie Wiesel, actually. Rav Menashe Klein, I did not even realize. A few years ago, I was in Israel, and I went to the cemetery in Sfat because I wanted to see where Yosef Karo's grave and some of the other gedolim there. And this was shortly after Rav Menashe Klein, a couple of years after Rav Menashe Klein had passed away. And he's buried in Sfat. I have no idea why he's buried in Sfat, what the connection is. Rav Menashe Klein is from Ungvar, Ujarad it's called today, and he has many, many volumes of responsa called Mishnah Halachot. In the yeshiva world, they don't really like Menashe Klein so much, and they have a joke that instead of Mishnah Halachot, it's Mishana Halachot, and he changes the halacha. And he does have some very unusual things in there, to be sure. On the other hand, he's an unbelievable London, incredible learning. And in a sense, he also preserves the old way of doing things. Like he's sort of, one day I'll write an article on him because I gave a speech on him years ago in Budapest. We had a conference on in Hungary. It was the first time I was ever in Hungary and I spoke on him. So for just to give you an example, how he wanted to really recreate Hungary in America or in Israel, this idea of women going to hear Parsha Zachar, he was very opposed to this because he thought this is all because of feminism, and feminism is like the worst thing for him, that women are coming to shul to hear Parsha Zachar. Whoever heard of such a thing in the old time? But of course, because of that also, he's a big makpid Erev. He was very important. He was a very liberal on Erevin because, of course, every community in the old country you needed an Erev. And when I say that he has unusual things is he was not a fan of women in the sense that women involvement. I mean, he has a tshuva in which he opposes the whole idea of women going to shiurim because a woman is not obligated in Torah study. A man is obligated. So if the woman goes, the man has to stay home with the kids. So, and it's the man's learning. I mean, it's just a small, almost without recognizing, you know, what the world is like and that women also need to do things and a man doesn't need to learn 24 hours a day. Some of the issues with women, he was involved in a very bad divorce and first marriage, and people say that that's why he has this negative comment. He also is very negative about Balei Tshuva. He doesn't like Balei Tshuva because it's hard to get a sense actually why. Sometimes it seems he doesn't like them because they're bringing in their bad yichus, the bad lineage, the whole ben nida, the whole issue. But it also, he talks about, he doesn't like the ideas that the Balei Tshuva come in. They come in with these crazy ideas. In fact, when he came to London to deal with the Erevin, I heard this from Rabbi Kimchi, and he heard that these people were opposing putting up an Erev. He said, are they Balei Tshuva? Because he thinks that the Balei Tshuva have this phony frumkeit. And He didn't like that. And he also didn't like converts. I hate to say it. He thought they're all phonies and frauds. So these are unusual things. But he, as I said, he was an unbelievable Amdin. His harim are full of, and he wasn't a crazy person in terms of hashkafa. He writes to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He writes to Rav Avram Shapiro, religious Zionists. He got his land for his yeshiva. Got it from the government. He survived Buchenwald. He wrote a book, I have it over here, Pursume Nisa, which his experience is there, and he describes it in his writings. Also, he doesn't like non-Jews. That's really his... Okay, he went through the Holocaust, so maybe we can cut him a little slack. But some of the things he says, it's terrible, especially when you consider that his closest friend, really, or one of his closest friends, was none other than Elie Wiesel. They were together in Buchenwald, and then they were together after the war, and the Beis Medrash in Kiryas Unvar was named by Elie Wiesel in memory of his parents. And I always wanted to ask Elie Wiesel, I only met him once, you know, Elie Wiesel, the great humanist, does he realize that the things that are studied by his friend, you know, are really very much opposed to his ideals? But they all remain to the end, they remain close friends. And that is Rav Menashe Klein. He, by the end of his life, he functioned almost like Hasidic Rebbe, even though there's no Hasidus called Unvar. No, Rav Menashe Klein was not the Debrecener Rav. The Debrecener Rav is someone else named Moshe Stern, and he definitely is not a Hasid. They're Chasim Sofer Ashkenazim. So let me tell you what Rav Menashe Klein says about this and this question. And this is also for again from 1986, and he goes through the whole thing, and he makes the argument that halachically, it's okay. It's more important to daven with a minyan, even if you're after the time. And then he says that, he also uses psychology. He says that if you don't do this, the minyan completely could be lost. He says, if people start seeing that you don't always get a minyan, that you have to daven, let's say, by 9 a.m., and they don't get there to 9:15, and then the minyans, they miss the minyan, they're going to stop coming. His understanding of psychology is that if you're strict on this, it'll lead to the loss of the minyan, whereas Rav Mordechai Yahu, just the opposite. They're arguing about psychology, and I don't know whose psychology is correct. He ends it off after saying that you should wait. Nevertheless, Nachum Lishtadel Levakesh Maban Lishtalel. She is Zarzu Asman Vevobisman. He says you should try to encourage them to come early. But now this tshuva, by the way, appeared in a sefer, Mishnah Halachos. So that's you can ask your local rabbis. I don't know. I think in the small towns or in small shuls, this is something that probably comes up among everyone. Maybe some of your shuls have practices minhagim. Of long standing of what to do in a situation like that. If you call people, I know that in the shul in West Orange or Torah, they do call people to come, and but they daven early enough. They daven like 8 o'clock during the winter, so it's not that problem. But if you're davening at 9 or 9:15, you could run into problems. Okay, let's do one more, and then we'll up to Simon Vav. And this relates to, we have a number of people on here who came with me to Morocco. This relates to my love of Morocco, which I've had for many years. Here's a picture of Rav Moshe Malka. Rav Moshe Malka was a Rav in a few different places in Morocco. He then comes to Casablanca, where he's a Rav of... he's on the Basin there in Casablanca, and in the, I think it's like 72, if I'm not mistaken, he goes on Aliyah, and he becomes the chief rabbi of Petach Tikva. And he remains the chief rabbi of Petach Tikva until the end of his life, which he dies in 1997, born in 1911. He wrote a number of volumes of Tshuvot called Mikveh Hamayim, but he also wrote the Heshiv Moshe, it's called. He has notes on the Torah Tamima, all sorts of other things. A big Zionist, as they all were Zionists, all these Sephardic rabbis. basically. You had a tiny group that weren't in Jerusalem, but for them all, I mean, the idea of not being a Zionist in Morocco, who didn't want to return to Eretz Yisrael? So some of the leaders weren't observant. Okay, we'll make them observant. It was an entirely different conception. He came to actually public, I shouldn't say renown, but maybe infamy in the Ashkenazic world, because he went up against Rav Yoshev. And he actually wrote about this in Tehumen. He has his article there. In Petach Tikva, you might recall, this was in the 80s, I think, the late 80s, maybe the early 90s, they had this movie theater that was open Friday night. And the firm would protest against this movie theater. They did it, I think, for like a year straight. Every Friday night, they'd stand there with signs because it broke the status quo or something. And after about a year, Rav Moshe Malka says, enough. We've done our share. We've given them hasra, warning, not natochacha. We've given them rebuke. They're not listening. And he says, to do this anymore is actually usur, because it's causing the policemen to violate Shabbos. It's causing the news people to come out. They'd come out every week and they'd do shows on this. And then the secular Jews would come and they'd start screaming at the religious. And he says, it's causing chilul Shabbos. It's causing terrible things. And therefore, we have to stop it. And Rav Yoshev came out and said, no, he wrote him a letter. This is all published in the Tchumen, and he included it in the volume Veheshiv Moshe, I believe, or it's in, no, yeah, Veheshiv Moshe. He includes his correspondence in which he responds to Rav Yoshev and responds to the entire Ashkenazic rabbinate, including in Netanya, in Petah Tikva, saying, I'm not doing it anymore. And then after he backed out of it, it basically fell apart because, when there's two chief rabbis in Petah Tikva, when the Ashkenazi wanted to go on and the Sephardi didn't, that pretty much ended it. He also, it's of interest that he said that when you come to Eretz Yisrael, he didn't invent this. At first I thought he invented it. I found it later. It's in the Chagiz, Rav Yaakov Chagiz in Halachot Ketanot, says the same thing. But he got the credit as like saying it, that he said that when you're in Israel, you should say, we say in benching, we should go kom yusleir tseinu. We should walk upright to our land. But if you're living in Eretz Yisrael, it should be kom yus be'art tseinu. I don't know today. Maybe some of you were in Israel recently. You know, if the general minhag is to change the nusach there. But that's what he said. He was, as I said, so he was one of the, when the Moroccan Jews look at their rabbis, we'll talk about Rav Masas. And then they have a few others of great importance. So I wrote to him. Why did I write to him? Because I wrote to him about Morocco, Moroccan minhagim. And then I also wrote about other things. In fact, in his letter to me, he begins, this is from 1991. Kodem kol, samachti lishmoa shebikarta et Morocco. He says, I'm happy to hear you visit in Morocco. V'chiraita et batei kanesu v'batei almen shakol kiot gotsham. But you saw all those synagogues and cemeteries, lake communities. That certainly must have given you great joy. Morocco was a great, a great center of Jewish life before the state of Israel. Almost 250,000 Jews and many rabbis, great rabbis, etc. Almost all of whom came on Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. So I see it's already 9:25. What I'm going to do is next class, we'll pick up with my questions, more than one question to Rav Moshe Malka, and you'll see, I don't want to say a Moroccan perspective, but I don't think an Ashkenazi would give these answers. You know, the Moroccans, the Sephardim in general, they don't know denominations. So you get a Klal Yisrael perspective. Remember, in a Moroccan synagogue, you go there today, you see it. Unfortunately, about 10 Jews died in Casablanca from the Moroccan community. Unlike in Tunisia, I'm in touch with the people in Tunisia. In Djerba, a couple were sick, but no one died. And Tunis, as we speak, not one Jewish person has even gotten sick. And then Tunisia in general has done a great job. I don't know what they did, but it's very little. But remember that there's only one shul in Morocco. That's the traditional shul. So everyone goes there. the people who are completely observant and the people who are quasi-observant, semi-observant, the ones who are observant when they're in shul and when they leave shul, they're not so observant. So the Moroccan rabbis have a much broader sense of responsibility. There's no conception, well, this person is conservative or reform. Let the conservative rabbi deals with this. So we'll get some of that with the Moroccan rabbis, because this is old Sephardic approach. And Moroccans are Sephardim, remember. They're not the Iraqis. We call them Sephardim, but for the most part, they're not. They're Edot Mizrach, but these are real Sephardim. So let me take the questions. We'll stop here now. Simon Vav, I hope you found this so far of interest. It gets better. Let me go back now, take some of the questions and comment to me. The first thing I see before we go back is someone texting me that every 9-8 minyan and Shabbos has this problem part of the year. Yeah, so you get to, I don't know when Zman Tefillah is, because we just have a sign in my shul about Zman Kriyat Shema. You definitely don't hit Kriyat Shema. And before I go back, yes, for Mordechai Yahu started off as an extremist. You say started off as imply that he didn't end there. For Mordechai Yahu remained an extremist his entire life. He was able, I mean, he wasn't going to go burn cars or anything at the Mechalei Shabbos or anything like that, but he continued to have aspects of extremism that you see in his son, by the way, Rav Shmuel Eliyahu Sfat, this is why he's such an interesting figure. I will get to him. Yaakov Yellen says, the university with which he received my degree, Santa Clara, is a Jesuit university institution. Yes, and if you recall the last class on the Mir Yeshiva, we mentioned that the Rabbi Dov Zakheim's father, Rabbi C. Zakheim, he got a law degree from Aurora University, which was a Jesuit university in Shanghai. So we have a number of Jesuit universities. Actually, it's important as a Jesuit where I work, because I get parsonage. As I'm a teacher of the theology in the religious institution. We all know about the parsonage in America for the day schools, but if you work in the theology department at the Catholic or even if you work in Emory University, which really has no religious component at all anymore, but it was founded and still exists in theory, that if de facto this way, you get parsonage. Shmuley says, what about the Rambam with Hagos of the Maron Padua? What do you mean? The Hagos, there was a private publisher who printed the Rambam with the Maron Padua. It wasn't the Catholic Church. That was, there was a big dispute over the publishing of the Rambam, which some people have claimed was actually what led to the burning of the Talmud. But no, that was not the Catholic Church. What someone told me, I wrote about this on the Sfarim blog, was that Rabbi Yonason Eibschitz published his commentary on Bereishis, on Brachos, that he got assistance from the Jesuits at their university in Prague. But I looked into that, and that's not true, and I confirmed with Schneier Lyman, there's no, so as far as I know, the volume, three volume I published are the only Sfarim ever published with the assistance of Catholic money, but if I'm wrong, please let me know. But I don't know. Kay Shiner of Mazuz's reaction upon reading the new Sefer. I could send you the link. He discussed it in one of his Motzei Shabbos. He discussed even a letter.
Wait a minute. Isn't the site that Karen ordered from?
He discussed a letter from Ramosha Klein, and he gave me a bit of a kavod, which I'm not saying I deserve it, but he gave it to me. He referred to me, as he likes doing these acronyms, Patach, Professor Talmud Chacham, and he said that you can, just because you're a professor doesn't mean you can't be a Talmud Chacham, which I guess is true. I'm not going to say that I'm one, but that's very interesting. I can send you the link to that. Shmuley says the Zilbermans are in the Arab quarter. They're Zionistic. Well, I don't know where they live, but they learn in the Chorva synagogue. I mean, I just was there, and that's where they're learning all day, and that's where I see them. So when you say they're in the Arab quarter, you mean they're shuls in the Arab quarter or what? Because they were learning, at least when I was there, they were learning in the Chorva Shul. Maybe not all of them, but there was a bunch who were learning there with the Tefillin and the Tcheles. And yeah, they're like Zionist. Well, they don't go to the army, quasi-Zionist. I don't know. Ramosha and Yerev, I don't know. Mel and remembers the sign of Budapest. Then Yaakov remembers the sign, if he recalls it, it said that the shots must have an Ashkenaz by the order of the Kadmonim. Okay, I took a picture of it, but I don't want to get it up now. Israel says, the Mishnah Berurah says, you should have the Achidos instead of davening with a minyan after Shkia. So that would imply, I was looking at Shacharis, so that's why I didn't see that. That would imply in Kavachomer, Shacharis would be the same thing. But we don't assume, correct me if I'm wrong, Israel, we don't assume that that we follow the Mishnah Berurah. There's so many sources that say you can go into, and many people in general, just Hasidim, of course, they don't, they daven later. Not to mention the fact that you can talk about which Shkia. You can always say, well, that we can go with Rabbeinu Tam. I've been around enough to know that, at least I think, that generally people are willing to wait past Shkia to if you can daven with a minyan. Ah, so here it is. Okay, so then I didn't, thank you for telling me. So it is there in Mishnah Berurah. This is when I was a youngster. I didn't find it, but none of them quote it though. So Yair says better daven yechidus and after, okay, there you go. There's the answer. Had I found it, I don't know why I didn't find it. Had I found it, I wouldn't have had to ask the question. But it's interesting there. Menashe Klein doesn't quote it. Mordechai Eliyahu already, so he's not Mishnah Berurah. Okay, Shmuley says there's a Hasidic community in Tzfas in the 18th century. The Binyan Sion section, they had Hasidim, the Aliyah. The Binyan Sion sites Rav Nosson Adler that women should go to hear Zachar. Yes, the Binyan Sion cites Rav Nosson Adler. You know, though, Rav Nosson Adler is the first one ever to say this. And in Europe, it never took off. It was very slowly. And in Hungary, for instance, no one ever did this in Hungary. In Germany, I believe they did. In Lita, maybe it started. This is a Chiddush, though, of Rav Nosson Adler. But in Hungary, Rav Menashe Klein says women never heard, and in the Sephardic world, women never did it, came to hear it. According to the Rishonim, women are potter from Parsha Zachar because they give different reasons. One of the reasons, Sefer Chinuch, is because women love the nos mochamo, that they're not soldiers. And the remembering Amalek is related to warfare. And that gave rise to the big joke a few years ago that based on this logic, the yeshiva students were all saying that we can't be drafted because, we're not soldiers. So therefore, the joke was that they shouldn't have to listen to Parsha Zachar because they said that they're not soldiers. You would assume he's buried there because his grandfather. That would be the reason, exactly. I didn't know. I'm glad. I asked a number of people and no one was able to tell me that. So thank you for that. Yes, Ungvar, Ujarat, I believe it's in the Ukraine now. You can read in the introduction to one of his volumes. I think it might be volume one. He describes about the history, and Ungvar had great rabbanim, real gadol Yisrael, but not Hasidic. Driving poskim. How many simonim? So there's.
Mark, I pointed, it's 168. I have the book in front of me.
Oh, 168. Okay.
We're going to be here for a long time. We're going to have a lot of classes.
Hey, if the people are interested, I'm into
it. Very interesting. Yeah. I think it's great. You have lots of classes. And by the time we finish, the library will be open in Scranton, and you can get everything.
Yeah. I said, for example, I almost had the stuff I need for Weissmandl, but Yehuda Bauer has a book called Jews for Sale, in which he takes issue with Weissmandl's telling of the story. For me to do it the way I want to do it, I need to have access to all these books. That's, as you know, they've been with me in previous years. I try to get everything, even if there's only one copy in the country at YU or something, or Harvard, and Scranton orders it for me. Yaakov says parsonage is a highly beneficial tax treatment, as you undoubtedly know. Well, that's why I get it, and now the women are getting it, and the Haredim started with this. They started doing it, and all the schools that I know in the New York area, they got one of the big firms gave us, because you can't ask the IRS ahead of time, is this okay for whatever reason, but I can send it to anyone who's interested, an opinion from one of the big law firms, and based on that, the schools in the New York area, either they give all women Limudei Kodesh teachers parsonage, or they have to have like a master's. Parsonage means that the cost of your house, and that includes everything, the heating, etc., the telephone, that's out of it's not taxable income. So it's very, as a former Rav, you probably took advantage of that also. Every few years you hear about people suing and that, that it'll be declared unconstitutional because it really, I don't see how it is constitutional, but no, they don't want to mess with the clergy. So thank you. I'm going to check that Mishnah Berurah there. I didn't realize that. Mel says Moshe allows 9 minutes after Shkia. Rabbi Rakefet, CZ says, Herbert Danby, yesterday, son of Hill for aid in the translation, is it true? Herbert Danby was the Anglican canon in Jerusalem, and he came out with the first English translation of the Mishnah. I cannot for the life of me imagine that he ever would have asked Rabbi Zonnefeld or anything to do with him. I think Rabbi Rakefet is confused. Eliezer ben Yehuda, for his dictionary, asked questions to Rabbi Zonnefeld, also to Rav Cook. Or they say he asked Rav Zonnefeld. We're talking about when he was more in the religious mind. When he came to Eretz Yisrael, at first he was he dressed the part. His wife wore a shadel, the whole bit. But I don't know. I never heard that about Herbert Danby. Ear has the inside scoop. Okay, Shlomo Gansri Shmuel was from Ungvar. Very good. Very good. So Sima, we'll end with Sima. Very interesting. Let's try for as many 168 as you can manage. Okay, like I said, I can manage because this, I live this, and I don't need this. Only thing I do ahead of time is I like to get you the pictures so you see who I'm talking about. But the rest of the stuff, and the Sefer, by the way, was published, printed in Lakewood. So I guess that, it was printed in Lakewood. So that gives us, what can I tell you? Okay, everyone. Thank you all for being here, and God willing, next week, Rabbi Kelman, anything?
Thank you. Tomorrow morning, Marty Lakshin, the last of his series on the Ramban, being also a fascinating series, 11 a.m. in the morning. And please, I encourage everybody to register for our medical ethics conference. That's on Sunday. That needs a separate registration from all these classes. There's no cost, but that does need a registration unless you want CME credits. Really a fantastic program on Sunday. El Ziegler will be giving an extra shiur 9:30 Thursday morning. We have our regular schedule. Just keep posted by all the emails. It's a pleasure to see as many people as I see the names. Everybody should be well, and it's pleasure to have the community here together, at least on this level, and learning together. And Dr. Mark, I really want to thank you. I enjoy all your class and everything, but I found this extremely, even more interesting than usual. And I do have the book, as you know. You sent it to me, and I've read part of it. I've read most of it, but it really.
I'll tell you something. Hold on. And this is off the top of my head. This is a lot of. I sent it to Rabbi Kelman. One of his children was going from Canada, and I apologize because someone emailed me, and I asked the guy who distributes it. It's like from America. It's like $20 to ship to Canada, which I don't know. Why it's so expensive. So he got airmail treatment there. And again, Marty Lakshin, for those who don't know, he's like the world's expert on the Rashbam.
That was last week's. That was.
But he's an expert in all forms. Correct. Of medieval parshanut.
It's excellent.
And everything. It's excellent. So if you haven't heard it live, you can listen to the tapes. And thank you all, everyone. And till next week, God willing.
Lila Tov, everybody. Thank